Hi everybody, it's Barbara Phillips. Sorry about that. I got disconnected from the call, but we are going to get our recording starting now and get going here. So I want to welcome all of you to this evening's teleseminar. This is, many of you have been coming to the NP interview, so this is the first one that you're coming to that is just me talking about doing your business. So I'm going to start as if we've never talked before. So, hello everyone, this is Barbara C. Phillips, founder of NursePracticianerBusinessOwner.com, and I am so thrilled that there are so many of you that have chosen to be here this evening, and I want to thank you for joining me on this no-cost teleseminar this evening called Getting Started in Your Own Practice. Tonight, I'm going to take you through the steps that you can take to get your own practice started in just a few months with as little cash, drama, and stress as possible. Now, there are hundreds, literally, I've been a little bit overwhelmed, of nurse practitioners and PAs and other clinicians that have signed up for this call and that have been sending in questions. And I see in the chat box now, if you're on the webcast where you can enter questions, there's a ton of questions in there. So I'm going to try and get as many of those answered tonight as I possibly can. But I know I'm not going to get to all of them. So I just want you to know that I do plan on addressing all of those questions in the weeks to come. But right now, we're going to spend the next hour or so covering as much information as absolutely possible that we can on getting started in your own business and practice immediately, avoiding some of the mistakes, some of them quite costly, that I made myself when I got started. And if you're already in business, my hope is that you're going to get a lot of information that you can use to grow your business and maybe to make some changes. I know, obviously, when I got started, there were things that I did that I'm still changing. So, and that's true for all of us because we're constantly learning and constantly refining. And as you know, healthcare itself is changing at an incredibly rapid rate. And it's important for all of us to keep our business skills up to par, as just like we do with our clinical skills. Again, there is so much to cover. I want to encourage you to take notes. And to help you with that, you should have received in your email that brought you here a link to a PDF document that you can download, and that'll help organize some of your note-taking a little bit, and I've also put some links in there for some resources that I'll be talking about. If you don't have it right in front of you and you're on the web, you can there's a link there that you should be able to click and get that information. So I want you to go ahead and do that now, and I'm going to do a little bit of housekeeping here that I think is pretty important. You know, first of all, you need to know I'm a nurse practitioner, and so I use the term NP because that's what I am. However, I do want to recognize that we have a lot of non-NP providers on the call, including PAs and NRNs and others. So please know that I'm addressing all of us, and I'll try to make sure that I'm using the term clinician. Secondly, because there are so many clinicians from across the country, and indeed from across the globe, I've been amazed, the information I'm giving here is general. You have to take the responsibility, know your state laws, know your rules and regulations for your own state and your own region. And finally, I am not a lawyer, I'm not an accountant, and I don't play one on TV. So you need to get the final professional determinations on some of this stuff, like on the legal issues and the tax issues, from the professionals in your area. Because, again, everything changes from state to state to state. And unfortunately, we don't get to practice under the same rules everywhere. Now that I've got all of that out of the way, let me tell you a little bit about me and how I came to be talking about business development for clinicians. My path, I think, to becoming an NP is probably not unlike a lot of yours because it's kind of convoluted. I first became an RN back in 1978, and I realize some of you weren't even born then, but back in 1978, and I received my first NP certification as a geriatric nurse practitioner in 1988. In 1996, I went back, got my BSN, and I followed immediately getting my master's in nursing as an FNP in 1998. You might say I've been around for a little bit. And I'm going to be completely transparent with you because, you know, this question comes out quite a bit. And one of the things that comes up is, you know, I never had any intention of starting a practice. And actually, I had thought about it. But every time I asked different people about starting my own practice, they told me it was too much of a headache, it was too difficult, there were too many problems, and so I kind of gave up on the whole idea. But in 2006, absolutely everything changed because I found myself working part-time in a practice that was completely unhealthy from a medical, legal, ethical, and spiritual point of view. And I had to get the heck out of Dodge. The problem was there weren't a lot of job openings that were available to me in my small community, and there weren't the ones that were there, I didn't want to go there. So with my patients asking me where else they could see me, with my not finding a practice that I would feel comfortable going to, I decided to open up my own doors. And so about 6 months after I started working in that particular practice, I left and a month later opened my own practice. And, you know, that sounds pretty fast, and it is. And actually, I do know of people who have opened their practices in less time than that. For me, one of the things that I had done is about 3 years prior to this, I had been thinking about business. So I had done a lot of business education. I had been working with business mentors. I'd taken lots of courses. I was looking at goals, all this kind of stuff. So I felt like when I got there, I had a pretty good business background. And how we came to this is that, you know, that business education doesn't teach you really about practice. And what I did is I started asking questions of other clinicians and started, you know, online and in with local colleagues and stuff. But people kept coming back to me with the same questions and more questions. I ended up writing an article. I got even more email. And pretty soon it was overwhelming the amount of email I was getting. So I thought, okay, let's blog about it. I can get all these questions answered for a lot of people. I don't have to keep resending the same emails over and over again. So I blogged. I wrote articles about business and practice startup and business ownership. And from there, it kind of grew. We did some webinars. We've done teleclasses. We created Nurse Practitioner Business Owner. We've done and produced the NP interviews. And I've worked with lots of NPs and PAs privately. This year, I'm adding speaking to all of those activities because I'm presenting at several state and national conferences. And, yep, I still see patients in my office 4 days a week. So sometimes I'm tired. Anyway, let's get going on this. I want to walk you through the practice startup system. It's a roadmap or a blueprint, you can think of it, that I wish I had when I got started. It kind of sets it up so that you can go from point A to point B to point C so that you can get your practice going. It's set up for a primary care office, but really it can be used for any type of a practice or even business setting because a lot of the principles are the same. And as you know, practice startup is a huge, huge topic. So while I'm going to cover as much as I possibly can in the time we have tonight, there are a number of you who have already sent in questions wanting to know more, how you can get more information, knowing that we can't cover everything. So, you know, if you stay on the line, we'll get to a resource that we'll make available to you toward the end of the call. But right now, we've got a lot to cover, so let's get right going here. If you have your document in front of you, great. If you don't, just grab some paper so that you can take some take some notes. You'll be getting an email with a replay to this, plus it'll have the link for the PDF document so that you can have that. As you know, starting your own business and practice is rather time-consuming. There's a whole lot of pieces to it, but it can be done. But in order to do so, just like you're doing anything, if you really want to do it, you've got to make a commitment to doing it and a commitment to move forward with it. That means making time and space in your life. You might have to schedule it in your day planner. You're going to have to involve your family. You're going to need to make space to hold the beginnings of your business, either in a home office or even in a bedroom, but someplace to put all your documents so that you can get organized. And it also helps you get into a frame of mind if you have a workspace that you can go to. And I want to address something because this comes up with questions and some of the questions I've gotten this evening. You know, if you are currently working, I do not advise that you quit your day job just yet. You know, there are people that can do that, but, you know, it takes a little while to get the practice going, and then it takes some time to get the monies coming in. And so if you need to think about supporting yourself, I don't advise that you quit your day job. I know from the many questions that have been submitted that people want to know about the types of practices and businesses that clinicians can start. So I'm going to tackle this right up front here. Basically, you're limited only by your imagination. As providers, we're pretty creative and we're pretty adaptable, and we want to provide a service to our patients and our clients. That's how come we became clinicians. So other than the legal implications and limitations that you might have where you are, you can pretty much do almost anything. So let me just go through just kind of a quick list. Most of us, as we know, do primary care. But there's a lot of us that do women's health care, diabetes specialties, midwifery, women's health, men's health, house call practices, psych and mental health practices. Some of us do medical spa practices and aesthetics. Some do pain management, alternative health care, walk-in clinics, urgent clinics. Some people do a corporate type of practice, a travel medicine, and just a whole lot of others. We have nurse practitioners that work as consultants. They will do corporate wellness and consulting, health coaching, life care managers. Some act as consultants to geriatric patients. Other clinicians will choose businesses such as staffing agencies, continuing education, certification review courses, training programs such as critical care, ACLS. There's a nurse practitioner, and I'm sorry, somewhere in the South who teaches people how to do joint injections. So it really can be all sorts of things. Some of us do public health education, such as teaching CPR, diabetes education, childbirth education, or teaching caregivers and CNAs how to do their type of work. Some nurse practitioners and clinicians are authors, speakers, TV, and radio personalities. Some of us have adult daycare. Some of us have child care centers and sick child care centers. We provide professional development. I have spoken with a nurse practitioner who's an internet marketer, and, of course, business development skills to clinicians, which is what I do. So while that list sounds really, really long, it's only a tip of the iceberg. So basically, you can do whatever it is that you want to do as long as you are functioning within the state laws and your licensure limitations. So when I tried to divide all of this up, I looked at, I initially came up with like 19 steps, and I tried to condense it down to 7 main steps. And that's what I want to try and get through in hopefully the next 45 minutes. And if we go over a little bit, I hope that that's okay with all of you. So the first step is what I termed the PPFM analysis. And that stands for personal, professional, financial, and marketing areas that you need to look at. And I turned those letters around there. But and we're going to go through each of those steps. But what is really important about it is that this is the very first thing that you must do you must do, because if you don't do this, there's no point in going on to the rest. And you don't want to get ahead of yourself. You don't want to, you know, it's the foundation. It's just your foundation, and you must do it, and that's all I'll say about that. So on the first part of it is the personal analysis, the personal inventory, and basically you want to answer the question, which this whole thing does. It answers the question, should you start a practice? But you're looking at what are your particular goals. Why on earth do you want to start a practice? You know, it's certainly not something that's easy, but why do you want to do it? What are your goals? You need to look at your goals in terms of your personal, professional, financial, your lifestyle goals. You know, what about your family? What kind of support systems do you have in place when you take on this role as an entrepreneurial clinician? What will it look like for you if you're successful? And what does success mean to you? That's a very individualized thing. You also want to really look at the idea, are you an entrepreneur or are you an intrapreneur? The difference being an entrepreneur goes out and does things on their own. An intrapreneur stays within an employed situation, but still has that kind of entrepreneurial spirit, but they want to stay employed. So they're actually a huge, huge access to any business owner. So if that's you, that's cool. You want to do that, and I would actually like to find somebody like that for my own business. So, you know, starting your own business and your practice eats up a whole lot of time, energy, and potentially your finances. You might have to give up vacation time, weekends, and evenings, especially when you're first getting started. So that's why it's really important to bring your family into this, because there's just a lot that goes on. And I'm going to throw this in here, but it really has to go through the whole thing. You want to think about, what is this going to look like for you? How do you want it to be? How does it incorporate into your life when you're done with it? What is your exit strategy? And that's something that's really important, because that's going to influence how you create your business. When you're looking at the professional analysis, the professional inventory, this is pretty easy for most of us to do it. It's pretty straightforward. And basically, you need to look at the rules and regulations for the state and region. You need to look at your practice limitations regarding your scope of practice and what your expertise is. And even more important is, do you have the skills to be an independent provider? A lot of times in a lot of the offices that we open, we're alone. Are you at that level to where that you can function alone and not have somebody down the hall or in the office next door? So you need to look at that. In this arena, too, you also want to look, do you have a collaborating physician or do you need a collaborating physician, and what does that look like? You also want to look at what the rules are for the state that you're in, not for your practice, but for business. For instance, I spoke with a nurse practitioner who's also a PA in California, and he was telling me about some of the rules there. For instance, you cannot own your own business in California. You can own 49% of it, but a physician has to own 51%. So you need to know those kinds of things. When we move on to the financial analysis, the financial inventory, that's something that's pretty important, because you really need to look at where you are financially, what your needs are, what kind of resources that you have available, what kind of support do you have available, how much money is it going to take you to get started in your practice. So you're going to want to look at estimating your income, estimating your overhead, and start looking for places where you're going to find the capital to get going. And we're going to talk a little bit about that a little bit later, but this is something that you want to start now. A lot of people ask me, how do I figure out how much I'm going to make? And so I want to address that part right here, because there's a lot of confusion about that. First of all, with Medicare, I get a lot of email, and people consistently say we only get 80% of the physician allowable. And in truth, While it's not a big difference, we get 85% of the physician allowable with Medicare. The exception to that is a new ruling that just happened for nurse midwives. They will be getting 100% of the physician allowable. Hopefully, the rest of us aren't too far behind, but right now, we get 85% of the physician allowable. Now, you need to then understand where that 80% comes from because of that amount. So, for instance, if the physician gets 100, we're only going to get 85. Of that 85, we only get 80% from Medicare. That other 20% has to come from elsewhere, either the secondary payer for that patient or the patient themselves pays it. If the secondary payer is DSHS, most of the time we're out of luck. So you need to kind of understand that. One of the implications in this is that just recently Aetna sent out a memo stating that as of June 1st, they would be following the Medicare guidelines and will be reducing reimbursement to nurse practitioners and PAs to 85% of the physician allowable. I don't know if this is going to be a trend we're going to be seeing with other insurance companies. I hope not. I hope that what we'll actually see is what has happened to midwives and that we start getting 100%. So all of you have access to your Medicare reimbursement rates. All you have to do is go to your local Medicare intermediary and you can download that. You also all have access to your DSHS reimbursement plans. Most of the insurance companies don't like to publish that information. In fact, they don't even want you talking to one another about it. In estimating your startup cost, it's basically just doing a little bit of research. Kind of take a look and see what your rents are running in your area. Get online, start looking at the costs of different equipment and things like that. Think about your staffing patterns that you want to have, all of those sorts of things. So you really just got to play with it. And unfortunately, we can't go into too much detail on that this evening. We're not going to have time. But, you know, I have written about this. And I want to remind all of you that you can go to nursepractitionerbusinessowner.com, and on the front page you'll see where it says Progress Note Archives. You'll find a lot of the articles on a lot of this kind of stuff there. So I want to move on to the M in the the PPFM analysis. And I see I've done this backwards, but anyway, the market. The market is what you are probably used to doing, I certainly did it in college, was a community assessment. And that's exactly what you're doing here, but you're just putting a little bit of a twist on it. One of the things to think about is if you go into your town and there are 10 other practices doing the exact same thing that you're planning on doing within a 5-mile radius, you've got to question, are your services needed? And I'm not saying that you shouldn't have competition, because competition actually is a good thing. It indicates, one, that there's a need for services, and two, it forces you to start looking at how you can do things differently and better than your competitors. So, but when you're doing this assessment, you want to look at the patient population in your community, what insurances that people tend to have, what their needs are if you're in a working community. Do people need after-hours care? With the practices that are out there, are they accessible? Is there a long wait for appointments? What is the environment like for some of these practices? And what needs are going unmet in your community? What locations are untapped? One of the things that I'd like to mention right here is the location issue, because I got an email right after people started signing up for this call asking me what the heck location, location, location has to do when you are trying to market to a low-income population, when you want to move and serve that particular population. And I think it has everything in the world to do with it. It doesn't matter whether you're talking about a community that has a lot of resources or a community that has no resources. Everybody wants to be in their own community, and so location is vital. You know, you're not going to want to go outside of your neighborhood necessarily to access services such as healthcare in a place that you're completely uncomfortable. So you know, whatever population you're serving, deciding to serve, you want to definitely look at your location. You want people to be comfortable. You want it to be accessible. For instance, is it on a bus line or a light rail line? Is it a safe place to be? Is there lighting in the parking lot? Is there disability access? All of those sorts of things. So location is key. I'm going to quickly move on here. Step number two is creating the business, and this really revolves around paying attention to all the rules and regulations and licensures so that you get the right business structure, the right numbers, and that you're following the right rules. In every location, and I believe in just about every state, it is the Secretary of State who regulates business licenses, and that's who you're going to want to go to their website. Oftentimes, you can actually get your business license and stuff right there online. You'll need to start thinking about different business entities, and we can't go into all of them right now, but I will say this. If you are thinking about being a sole proprietor, stop right now. You need to have a corporate entity, and that can be an LLC, it can be an S-Corp, it can be a PC, which is a professional corporation, it can be a PLLC, which is a professional limited liability corporation. It just really depends on what is in your state, because not all of these are in all states. Your accountant or your attorney can really help you with some of the advantages and disadvantages of each of those based on your location and the taxation in your area. You want to make sure that you're getting over to the IRS and getting something called an EIN number, which means Employer Identification Number, or Tax ID. And this is really important because that is like the Social Security number for your business. And your business actually, that EIN number is actually what a lot of the insurance companies that I deal with, they use that as my provider ID. So you definitely need to know that, and everybody wants that because you get paid on a 1099 from insurance companies, and that's the number that they want. And, of course, guess what? Your business entity, being an entity unto itself, a legal entity unto itself, needs its own NPI number. Now, I want to address one question that I had from someone about creating the business entity. I think it was a he, and I'm sorry if I'm incorrect here. But someone in California wrote in saying that he was advised that his attorney said that they would offer to create the business entity for him for a fee of $5,000, and he wanted to know if I thought that that was reasonable. And I don't know your situation for that, but I would say that I would really do some research and reading on it. That seems a little bit steep to me. And I'll tell you what I did. There is a company called Nolo. It's nolo.com. They have lots of legal books and software that can help you create business entities, and that's what I did. And so it was the cost of the book and the cost of filing, and I had my articles of incorporation, and it's worked out just fine. So, again, look at what is going on in your state. Look at the complexity of your rules, and look at the complexity of the business that you're trying to create. I would definitely make it a point of checking in with an accountant because that is a relationship that you will need to develop. And some accountants will help you get started at absolutely no charge. Mine did. But, you know, others will charge you a fee. But it's a good idea to check in with them, find out about the tax rules, how you set up your books, all of those sorts of things. And they can sometimes give you some advice on different legal structures as well. You need to have insurance, not just your liability insurance that we all carry, but you need to have business insurance as well. I cannot stress that enough. And it has come in handy more than once. And you might also think about business interruption insurance and disability insurance. In terms of your collaborating physician and insurance, some of them want you to carry them. Some of them have their own plans, and it's just something you're going to have to work out. But that's been a question that we've gotten as well. You know, let me take a moment to talk about collaborating physicians, because I think that's about the second or third most common question that I get from people. And right now, if I remember correctly, I think it's about 16 states where we need none to very, very little interaction with physicians as far as our terms of practice. One state, I think you only need physician involvement if you're prescribing Schedule 3, 4, 5, excuse me, 2, 3, 4, 5. And in another state, it's only after 2 years of your initial practice, the shackles come off and you're free to go. So I've written a lot about this. People want to know how to find physicians. I would say start with the physicians you know and start asking questions. If they can't help you, can they refer you to somebody who can? Who are your colleagues using? There's all kinds of very creative ways that you can find collaborating physicians. Another question that I get about this is what do you pay a collaborating physician? And again, this is something we've written about, but there are nurse practitioners who pay nothing to NPs who are paying over $1,000 a month. Some pay on a percentage, some pay on a commission basis. It's just whatever is going on in your local community and the agreement that you come up with the collaborating physician. I want to move on to step three, because that's all about getting paid, and that's one of the reasons we're doing this. And, you know, a lot of us, being that we were nurses to begin with, we're not all that comfortable sometimes about money or asking for money, particularly in healthcare. So I want you to write this down, because it's the mantra you have to operate on. If you think about your body, if you don't have any breath in your body, you're not alive, correct? It's the same thing with the business. If you have no cash flow, you have no business. It is absolutely vital that we get over whatever barriers we have about asking for money and making money in our businesses. Now, if you've opted to have a cash-only practice, some of what I'm about to talk about might not have anything to do with you, but I know of several NPs who started out with cash only to add insurances later, so you might want to pay attention. If you're just getting started, one of the first things that I often tell people to do as soon as they have their business structure in place is start your credentialing process, because it can take up to 3 months or longer sometimes. A lot of people are pretty terrified about the whole idea of credentialing. It's pretty cumbersome, but it really isn't that difficult as long as you make sure you've dotted your I's and crossed your T's and you keep track of everything and you keep it in one place. I have included in the PDF document a link to what is called the Washington Provider Application. It is a standard application that all of us in our state have to use to credential with insurance companies. But guess what? They use the same everywhere. So you can go and fill that out. It'll tell you what documents that you need. I mean, I was surprised that I even needed my diploma on these things, but they want all of this documentation. So you can put it together, keep it together, and you'll always have it available for submitting it. And one of the things that I did as well is I filled this out, saved it to my hard drive, so whenever I needed a new copy, I just printed it out, filled out the forms that I had to actually fill out and sign, and I was able to submit the whole thing. You want to keep track of everything on a spreadsheet, and you really want to document who you sent things to, when, who you talked to, what the outcome of the conversation was, and when you talked with them, because that comes in handy. You know, this stuff, while it may seem confusing to us, they're getting this from all sorts of people, and things do get lost. So this will help you out a great deal, and it really isn't difficult to do credentialing. Now, the state governments, the state insurances, such as Medicare and Medicaid, they do it their way. Medicare right now has started using an online system for credentialing, which I understand is quite quick. And also in the PDF document, you will have a link to the Medicare Advanced Practice pages where you can find out all of this information. Now, in order to get paid, you've got to be looking at how you're doing your documentation, and you've got to be looking at you've got to be looking at your coding and your documentation. Your documentation has to match what you have listed as the level of service that you've given, such as in an office visit, it might be a 99213, a 99214, a 99215. In the home care setting, you have different codes. Assisted living, you have different codes. If you think back to when we were all in nursing school, we all learned if it was not documented, it was not done. This is so true here, because if your documentation does not match your level of service and an insurance company asks for that documentation or audits you, then they're going to look at this and say you have committed fraud, because this you charged a 99214 and it was actually, the documentation was equivalent to a 99212. So you want to get those on par with one another. Again, in the PDF document that sends you to Medicare, you can find some of the documentation guidelines there as well. A lot of large offices will hire someone as a certified coder to read progress notes and assign the right ICD-9 codes and the right CPT codes, but for most of us, that's not a luxury we have, so you've got to learn how to do your coding and billing, your coding. We can't really talk about coding without talking about billing, because they're so intertwined. And with billing, boy, there's a lot of confusion and a lot of fear around that. And it's also something that is incredibly cumbersome. The actual billing, once you have your codes, that's not so bad. That's just the data entry. The hard part is, and the time-consuming part is, when that comes back and they've denied it for one reason, or you didn't dot your I that time or cross your T, and so you have to hunt things down. But again, knowing the right codes will help you here, and knowing what they actually pay for. One of the things that I've been so surprised on in my state, I have a very difficult time getting pap smears and things paid for. And it turns out that after age, I'm blanking out on the age. I knew it was age 40, but they've actually lowered it now. You cannot code a preventative care code on a female. You have to actually code it as an office visit, and oftentimes you don't get paid for the pap smear. When we talk about billing, let's talk about who does your billing for you, because this is a big question that I get. There's a lot of ways you can do this. You can have your billing in-house. You can find somebody, hire them, bring them in-house, and have them do your billing, or you can outsource. I want you to be very, very careful on either of those. None of them is perfect, and I don't think that I'm not sure that there's anything as a perfect biller out there. But if my biller's listening, I apologize. But we're all people, and mistakes get made. And when you start outsourcing it or bringing somebody in, it is incredibly important that you check out their references as thoroughly as absolutely possible, that you follow what they're doing. Whenever somebody is doing your billing, it's not that it's hands-off for you. You have got to keep up with it. You've got to see what your accounts receivable are, what kinds of bills are being denied. Not doing that will get you into trouble as fast as doing anything illegal. And I certainly learned that the hard way. That was one of the mistakes that I made early on. hiring, outsourcing my billing, and I actually ended up within 6 weeks having to do the billing myself just because we had nothing coming in. So that's how I learned how to bill. We can't talk about coding and billing or finances without talking about collections, and that's really kind of an icky part of any business. But there are going to be people that are just not going to pay you. They may give you bounced checks, unclosed accounts, anything like that. So you've got to think about upfront your financial policy. You've got to think about if someone doesn't pay you, how long are you going to let this go on? Are you going to send them to collections? If you send them to collections, are you discharging them or divorcing them from your practice? So there's all those things you've got to think about. Now I see I'm looking at the clock and I'm thinking, oh my goodness, we've gone 40 minutes and I'm only about halfway through, so I'm really going to pick up the pace here a little bit. But I also wanted to let you know about a resource that's available, because I know that some people cannot stay on the line, and I'm seeing exactly what we are having, all the comments that are coming in from people into the webcast. And so let me tell you what we've got here. To go into more depth than we can possibly do here, we've developed a 7-week nurse practitioner practice startup system, the NPBO practice startup system. It's 7 weeks. It's going to go into 7 different modules. It will have Q&A calls. It'll have the transcripts, the audio recordings, worksheets, templates, checklists, all sorts of information. Plus, this is something new that is in response to what you've been asking, and that's continuing education credits. So for those of you that want to check that out now, you can go to nursepractitionerbusinessowner.com/practice. Let me just get that link again. It's nursepractitionerbusinessowner.com startup system.html. So once again, nursepractitionerbusinessowner.com/startup system.html. And then just to let you know too, for the first 10 people that sign up for that, we have a special bonus, and we'll talk about that later because there's so much more to cover and I want to get back to this. So step 4 is what's behind closed doors. And that's what actually goes into the vessel. I mean, our business is a vessel, our location is a vessel, but it's what happens inside of that space that is what we do, and we need to outfit that space. We need medical equipment and supplies and furnishings and office equipment and supplies. But a big part of all of that is also the technology part, and that's becoming more and more of an issue for us. Right now, there's a huge movement, as you all know, toward an EMR system. And it can be pretty darn spooky if you are not technologically savvy. And some of the things that you need to think about when you start looking at an EMR is what kind of hardware do you need? How are you going to network your office? Are you going to do it wirelessly, or are you going to do it hardwire? And what are the security implications of both of those? What kind of computers do you need, and how many of them are you going to need? How are you going to interface that with a printer, and how do you network all of that, and what kind of software do you need? And all of that is pretty important, and that's what I want to talk just really quickly about. First of all, one of the things that I think that you need to look at is it doesn't have to cost you an arm and a leg. When we started our practice, I bought initially 2 new desktops, one for the front desk, one for my desk, and then in our lab, in our exam rooms, plus in the clinic area for our assistant, we had laptops. And those laptops I bought refurbished on eBay, so I really saved quite a bit of money. I also avoided this whole business of these big fancy printers, and I bought a really nice high-end Brother that has been a workhorse. And I have I paid actually less for that than I would have paid per month on a contract that somebody wanted to sell me. So really look at what you're needing in your office. Stop and look at actually what the flow is going to be and what you're planning on doing. Phones are absolutely a huge issue, and in our office, we've really maxed out our phones. One of the things that we're considering, and I know other practices are doing it, is actually switching over to a voice over IP, and one of those is ringcentral.com. You can have almost unlimited phone lines, and right now, like I said, we're pretty maxed out. In terms of software, you need it in your office. We all need some kind of an office suite, and the gold standard is Microsoft Office. And if you use that on more than one machine, of course, you have to have many licenses, and that can be rather spendy for a practice that's just starting up. There is a free open source suite that is equivalent. In fact, you can open up the Microsoft documents. You can save them as Microsoft documents, if you will. And that's called openoffice.org, and that is also in your PDF document. Google Docs is another good one. You can also set yourself up on an intra-office internet system through Google, and that's pretty self-explanatory. One piece of software I highly recommend that you get, and don't even look at anything else, is just go out and get QuickBooks. There's a little bit of a learning curve, but it's what all the accountants use, all the bookkeepers use, and it will save you a lot of time. You can learn to run reports and actually see your profit and loss, which is something you need to learn how to read. Now, EMR systems, EMR systems, there is money available to nurse practitioners. A lot of times you see people talking about the incentives that are out there and the $44,000. That is through Medicare, and that is something we are not eligible to receive. But NPs and PAs can participate in the incentives through their state Medicaid offices. And actually, if you participate during the entire time, my understanding is that you can actually receive up to $66,000 for your EMR system. Now, I don't have a lot of data about that yet because it all has to do with meaningful use, and that's still being defined. But that is something for you to consider. Now, I think I said this a little bit earlier, but there's lots of EMR systems out there. There are free ones to where you can spend tens of thousands of dollars. And I'm always asked, what do I use? And I will tell you, right now I am trying out Practice Fusion, and that's at practicefusion.com, and it's a free EMR system. What I like about it is it's web-based, and I had wanted to get away from the one that I had on the computer in the office. I wanted to go to web-based. What I like about it is it has some features. For instance, the electronic prescribing is real easy to use. It has a way to email my patients reminders of their appointments, which is really cool. There is a patient portal called Patient Fusion. I haven't used it yet, so I can't tell you anything about that, but I understand I will be able to, like, put the labs out there or any kind of communication that I want with patients, and that will save us a huge amount of time in the office. Another system that is out there is OfficeAlly.com, A-L-L-Y. Office Ally, I've never used their electronic health record, and I believe that's about $30 a month. But when I first started and I started my billing, I was using their practice management system, and I used it actually for a couple of years. And on that website, they now call it Practice Mate, and I was perfectly fine with it. It was a great way. It's free to providers. I was able to get my bills out. and manage my practice, or at least the billing part of my practice, through that particular piece of software. The biller I use now, she has her own system, and that's what we're using currently. The initial electronic record that I used is AmazingCharts.com. I've written a lot about them on our blog. I think I used them for almost 3 years. It was a great system. You paid a one-time fee and then just had an annual for updates and maintenance, and it worked very well. It worked very well, but like I said, I wanted to go back and I wanted something online. Now, Amazing Charts, since I stopped using them, they've had a major change and a major upgrade, so I really can't tell you how it's working now. I'm assuming it's better because there's a lot of really good things about it. With Amazing Charts, you can download a fully functioning demo, and you can use it, I believe, for 90 days, and maybe there's a limit on the number of patients that you can put in there. You need to look at your coding resources. There's a lot of them out there, and my favorite is Epocrates. Unfortunately, I don't have an iPhone. I wish I did, but we don't get AT&T in this area because I would keep it. Right now I'm using an old PDA with Epocrates, and I'm hoping I'll be able to upgrade to something that I'll be able to use that with. Medical supplies is something that we need to talk about, and being in small practices, it's really difficult, I think, for us to get good prices, because a lot of price cuts go to the big organizations. So when I was looking around, I stumbled across something called eSurge, and that's E and then S-U-R-G.com. And I can get pretty good prices there. I can also order in small amounts. I do not have to order 6,000 syringes at a time. So that saves me money, and it saves me time and energy, and they've got really good customer service. Again, you may have a different resource in your area that you've been using, and certainly look around. Don't be afraid to look at eBay for supplies. Don't be afraid to look at Craigslist for supplies, and that goes for equipment as well. Step 5 is clinical practice management, and this is really all about your patients. It's what happens to your patients from the moment they come in all the way through your office, all the policies and procedures that they're interacting with, your labs, infection control, how you're going to work with them on OSHA stuff, common procedures, emergencies, all of those policies and procedures that talk about how you work with patients. Who's going to do refills for you? What kind of procedures do you have in place if you want your assistant or nurse to be handling, say, a UTI? So all of those kinds of things are what you need to think about, and it starts from the moment that you check in the patient until you check them out. As you bring on more staff, it is really going to be vitally important that all of this stuff is documented. And that's been an area that we're trying to come up to par with. And one of the things that you can do is, if you already have a practice, have everybody start documenting everything they do. And then you can take that and put it into a policy and procedure form that everybody can operate under. Step 6 is operations and/or the business practice management. And I wanted to get to this because this is really big. This is actually the guts of your business. And it's not just about the financial management of your practice, but it's everything else that goes in there. It's your human resources. It's all of your risk management. It's your labor and industries or workers' comp issues. It's all of your OSHA guidelines and your HIPAA and scheduling and your phone calls and just all of that kind of thing, your disaster planning and fire drills. One of the things that that I really want to spend a few moments on are your financial policies. And because it's so critical to how your practice runs, and there have been, well, first of all, with patients coming in, you need to have financial policies in place. They need to be signing authorization so that you can bill their insurance company and receive that money. It should not go to them. It needs to come to you. You need to have policies about deductibles and copays and those sorts of things. But when you start looking at the real financial part of your practice, how are you getting paid? Where is your money going? Who is handling your money? Who is recording your money? Who's doing all of that? I've spoken to more than one nurse practitioner who lost her practice because of embezzlement. So this is critically important that you pay attention to all of this. If you have people doing different things for you, you do not want the same person who's opening your mail to be the same person who is recording and who is the same person who is going to the bank. If possible, you want to have all of your income coming to you and as a direct deposit. You want to be careful who has access to your debit cards and to your checking account and who can move money around. And I know that that sounds almost paranoid, but it happens over and over again. And so you just want to have systems in place that you don't ever really have to worry about that. Again, it's the cash flow issue. If somebody has embezzled your money, you don't have the cash flow to continue providing services. The other thing that I really want to mention here is taxes. More than one practice, more than one business, because this isn't limited to practice, has closed because of not paying attention to their taxes. Most of the time, we pay quarterly taxes for most businesses. Some of you will be paying monthly taxes, and that's to the federal government, not counting your state and local taxes that you have to pay. And we were talking with the accountant just recently about this because on April 15th, that's when our year-end stuff is due to the IRS, but on April 30th is also our quarterly taxes, which also coincides with the quarter for our state B&O taxes. And so April tends to be a really heavy month financially as far as outgo is, or as far as outgo goes, rather. And so you want to plan for that. You always want to be putting money aside for taxes. You also need to think about when you pay your staff, say you're paying them, and I'm just going to use for this for a round figure, $10 an hour. Well, that's just what you're paying them. You also have half of their Social Security. You've got self-employment taxes on them. You've got your state L&I tax, unemployment tax, both state and federal. So there's all these things that go into play that you need to be aware of and plan for, because the government doesn't wait for their money, and this is something that has unfortunately brought many businesses to their knees. I'm looking at the time, and I see that our hour is up, so I would like to get through this last system if you want to stick with me. Step 7 is marketing, and I've been known to call marketing the real job of any business owner. And it happens to be one of my favorite topics, and I can talk on it for a long time, so I'll try to keep this short. But the reason that I say that it is the real job of a business owner is because if you no longer have patients coming to your door, then you don't have any income, because we, in our line of work, make money when we see patients. So if the patients aren't coming to our door, we don't have that income. If we don't have that income, of course, that means we don't have cash flow. And if we don't have cash flow, that means that we don't have a business. So marketing is your most important job. I don't mean that you can't delegate it, because of course you can. But still, you need to keep up with what is going on. Now, what is marketing? You know, so many people think of marketing as just sales. And let me say something about sales. We sell every single day. We sell people on the idea of losing weight, of exercising, of quitting smoking, of taking their medications, of changing their diet. So selling is something that we do all day long. But marketing isn't just about sales. Marketing is everything you do every single day to bring patients in to your office. And it's not just what you do, it's what everybody does. When we're marketing, we need to really be clear about what it is that we're doing with people, why we're doing it, who are we doing it with. So we're going to be looking at all of that, who, what, where, when, why, and how of what we're doing. Now, you know, I'm going to point this out because a lot of people don't think about it, but how your staff answers the phone is marketing. What your office looks like is marketing. How people are treated when they come in is marketing. Because guess what? People go out and they talk about it. Oh, that office was just filthy. I'm never going back there. And that's that word of mouth marketing, that negative stuff, and that will shut you down as quick as you can, as quick as you can think it. And on the other hand, you can have the positive word of mouth marketing. So everything you do is marketing. So that's just something I drill it into your head. And marketing is one of the questions that I got from someone was, do I need to market online? And yes, you do. You absolutely do. One of the Pew Commission recently did a study on patients, and they've actually done this for a few years, and so they've been able to compare it. And more of our patients are what they call the connected patient or the e-patient. And they're expecting us to be online, and they're looking for us online. Now, this is something that a lot of offices haven't yet done. So here's something that all of you can do right now. You don't need a website. You don't need to have any kind of online skills to be able to do this. I put this link in your document. And what it is go to www.local.google.com, and you can put your business into your local area so that when somebody goes to look for, say, a women's health care provider in San Jose, California, your name's going to pop up. Most other offices are not yet doing this. And I have to tell you that even in my small town where I didn't think that anybody was internet savvy at all, I've gotten more people just from doing that. So again, it's www.local.google.com. And I believe Yahoo has one as well, and Yelp, which I've never used, I've heard, has a local search as well. So that's something that you want to do. When we talk about marketing as well, like I said, it's not just about sales, but it's everything you do. So some of the places that you can get started marketing your practice, and you start right away, even if you're just getting ready to open, is speak at community centers, speak at open houses, at health fairs, publish a newsletter, either online or offline. Doing them online is really easy to do. Look at what your customer service is in your office, how your phones are being answered, how your patients are greeted, what the culture of your office is. Look at your print materials, such as your cards and brochures, your forms, the signage, both in your office and for booths as well. One of the things that I'm using now is I actually send out cards to our patients, and you can try this out for yourself. If you go to www.npbocards.com, you can get a free account and sign up to send out some cards yourself, and I can send them out as cards or postcards to our patients, and it works really well for us. Networking is really something to think about, and something I don't think many of us do are our pharmacy reps. They go from office to office and office, and boy, did they talk about different offices and what's happening, not just amongst themselves, but with other providers. So they actually can be a marketing vehicle for you, just as other providers can. And one of the things that I think is up and coming and is really hot, and I'm going to be talking about it later this year, is social media. It's a great tool for marketing, and there's also some things that you need to think about for your patients. In fact, I just had an article come out in advance on whether you should friend your patients. And so I'd highly suggest that you think about that. And you might even, and I hadn't really thought about this before, but you might even talk to staff about what they put out on some of these social media sites, particularly if it at all will relate to your practice. I have patients every day asking me, well, why won't you be my friend? And I explain to them what our office policy is. And you want your whole office to be on board with that. I know that I have just gone through a whole huge amount of things here. I'm going to quickly look at the Q&As that are coming in, the questions that you all have been putting into the box. Somebody asked, is business insurance more than liability and equipment insurance? Yes, it is. Your business insurance is mostly going to be your slip and fall, your fire, your theft. And it actually will also, if your, you know, clerical person in the office spills coffee on somebody, all of those sorts of things. So it is very, very important. And if you do have expensive equipment in your office, you may need to have an additional rider on that. And for those of you that are doing like house call practices or long-term care practices when you're in your car all the time and you're going all over the place, you want to consider, is your car insurance that you currently have, is there adequate coverage if you were to lose any of your equipment? Somebody asks, will the webcast be available on the internet for later review? Yes, it will be. You will all be getting a link by tomorrow at the latest. Somebody asked about the most effective forms of marketing, and you've listed, this is Vicki. Direct mail, purchasing a mailing list, website optimization, all of that. I wouldn't purchase a list first time. I would actually just get out into the community. One of the things that I did when I got started is I went and talked to the emergency room, because they often see people in the emergency room that do not have providers, and that way they could refer people to me that needed follow-up care. Also, your hospital discharge planners, your local DSHS workers if you are taking DSHS, your community centers, went down to, like Curves and the Y and things like that. Up at the college where they have a nursing program, talked with those folks. So there's a lot of ways that you can market. That would be offline, online. Definitely website optimization is not going to hurt you, but that wouldn't be the first thing I would do. I would really look at doing the stuff that I talked about with local. And definitely as you build up your patient list and stuff, consider doing email marketing. And I shouldn't say email marketing. I mean newsletters, because you can actually keep people coming back in because you're reminding them, have you had your mammogram this month? You know, when was the last time you had your cholesterol checked? It's time for a diabetes check. All of those sorts of things. What is the link to the CARDS website again? I'm sorry. It is www.npbocards.com. And that's just my version of send out cards that I use. But you can sign up for a free account there. Let me look at a few more questions. I cannot find the Startup System 7-week course on the website. Okay, let me double-check that again for you. It is nursepractitionerbusinessowner.com/startup-system, S-T-A-R-T-U-P, SYTEM.html. And we'll also be sending out a link to that as well. Let's see here. Boy, we've got a lot of questions. What are my thoughts on grant funding as a financial source? Most of the time, if you're looking for grant funds, you need to be a 501c3, a nonprofit corporation, and then you're going to have to look for specific funding. So while it's possible, it really just depends on your business model. Deborah is asking, how many years of experience should one have before starting a private practice? I think that that's a little bit individual because all of us come to becoming a nurse practitioner with a lot of different experience. So, for instance, for me, with my very first nurse practitioner program that was just a certificate program, I had had already 15 years of critical care experience. So I was very comfortable with assessments. I was very comfortable with taking care of sick people and making decisions. Other people, they come to their programs maybe with 1 or 2 years of experience, and maybe it wasn't a lot of clinical experience. So it really just kind of depends on you, your specialty, what you're doing, your comfort level, what resources are available to you. But I never, never recommend that somebody who is brand new to the profession go out and start a practice. I just don't think that that's pretty wise. And, you know, even when I started my practice, I was nervous. Even though I had had a gazillion years of experience, it's still a little bit unnerving to know that you're the only one in the office. What is the common reimbursement monthly for a collaborating physician? Again, that just varies a great deal depending on where you are. Like I said, lots of nurse practitioners don't pay anything. Maybe they take call for that physician. Maybe they work in the office for that physician a couple days a week, something like that. And some people will pay up to $1,000+ per month. So it depends on your local culture, what the local trends are, and what you're able to negotiate with the physician. And remember, when you're going to physicians, you have a lot to offer. It's not just what you're going to get from them, but it's what you can give to them. And so I think if we go from a place of confidence and power, we can also often negotiate better deals for ourselves. Barbara in Grapevine, can you really predict how your patients would react if you change to cash only from insurance? Seems like a survey would tip your cards and scare people. If you are looking at changing your current practice, it is something that I think you need to give patients warning that you're going to be doing this, because that's kind of a shock. And a lot of patients don't understand the business of medicine. They just see that they have insurance, and they don't understand why their insurance isn't covering everything that they want it to cover. So you really research that, really look at some options. You know, certainly when you are changing from an insurance to cash, one of the things that you can offer your patients is to give them a bill that they can certainly submit to their insurance company and perhaps get their reimbursement that way. There's really no way to predict it. A lot of it's going to depend on what's going on in your community. If there's a lot of cash practices, then it's not going to be something that's foreign to them. If everybody in the community does insurance and nobody does cash, well, then it might be a little more of a shock to them. I'm going to do just another question or two here. Okay, I think we answered that one. Mary, you're asking, other than starting a medical clinic, what are some of the other opportunities? We did that to begin with. With the elimination of consult codes with Medicare, how will this affect revenue? Well, that really depends on how much you're using the consult codes. And a lot of times, if you're still doing that much work, you're going to be able to still charge, say, a 99204 if it's a new patient and you're putting in that much work, and maybe even a 99205. And I'm not so sure that there's a great deal of difference in those codes. I'd have to look and see what the previous reimbursements were. So with that, I'm going to stop the questions here, and I want to, again, just tell you a little bit more about the program that we are offering. The NPBO The MPBO Practice Startup System is a step-by-step systematic program for you to get started in your own practice. It's a high-quality, hands-on program. It's not like some of the programs that I've been involved in before where it was pretty much all fluff. And I can guarantee you it's not going to be that. There are 7 modules. We'll go through 1 per week. And the modules are pretty much the same that we've been talking about. PPFM analysis, creating the business, getting paid, what goes on behind closed doors, your clinical practice management, operations and business management, and marketing. You get 2 different Q&A calls, and we've already scheduled those, one for about halfway through the course and one about 2 weeks after the course is completed, so that we can make sure that we get all of your questions answered. You get all of the recordings of the calls that you can download, transcripts of all the calls that you can download and print them out and read them and do whatever you want to do with them. There are worksheets and templates and checklists to help you get started. And like I said, continuing education credits, which is a new thing that we're doing. It's been a question that I've gotten a lot. And so we are awarding 7 contact hours for continuing education, and you'll be getting a certificate for that at the end of the course. Now, I had said early on that I was going to give a bonus to the first 10 people. I'd started out with 5, and I thought, let's give it to 10 people. So for the first 10 people that order, I'm going to spend some one-on-one private time with you. We're going to do a 15-minute call to really get you focused on what you need to do. And that's just for the first 10 because there's just not that much time to do this with. This course is also offered at a bonus price or an early bird price of $197, and that's if you order before midnight on May 1st, that's Saturday, May 1st, midnight, and that's Pacific time, not Eastern, but Pacific time. So, again, the link for that is nursepractitionerbusinessowner.com/practice-startup-system. .html, and we will be sending that link out to you by tomorrow at the latest. I want to thank all of you for your questions, and like I said, for all the questions that I've received via email and the ones that we've gotten on the webcast, I will be answering those in the next few weeks to come, and I'll probably be doing them on video on our blog, which is at npbusiness.org. So thank you for your time tonight, and I wish all of you a really good week. Bye-bye, everyone.
The moderator has left the conference.